So my name is José Bové. Listen to health writers if you are concerned about the health of the body politic.
Good evening and welcome to Health Writers on the Air. I'm your host this evening, Steve Blank. Tonight's program is about food sovereignty. In a few moments, we'll be hearing from Joe Mingle, an urban gardener and food activist who's starting an urban garden at Union Corners. But let's begin this evening's program with an interview with John Peck of Family Farm Defenders, who came to the studio to discuss the cost of eating nutritious food, how it became so expensive, and what people in Madison can do to eat right and empower their communities. John Peck, welcome to Health Writers on the Air.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, John, one of the conversations that can be heard more and more frequently these days goes something like this. I know that I should be eating better, but it's too expensive. I mean, why should I buy a meal made of organically grown food when I can eat conventional food for half the price? How did we get to this position?
Well, I mean, one thing is to realize, you know, and I, just for a caveat, I do teach economics as well at MATC, so we talk about this in my econ class all the time, is like often prices don't reflect the true costs. So in our current system, food system, we massively subsidize conventional food in lots of ways, which we can talk about, usually through the Farm Bill program. And then also there's a lot of other costs which are not even taken into account, which other people end up bearing, such as the pollution, you know, the contamination, the exploitation of animals and farm workers. So, I mean, our conventional food system is actually very expensive in a lot of ways, but we don't see that reflected in the market price. And so that's why we sort of a false calculus that some food is cheaper than, say, organic food.
And how did our food system become so expensive?
I mean, a lot of it is what we have this, quote, cheap food policy, which is externalizing a lot of these costs onto the environment, onto people, onto animals and plants. And we also have, the taxpayer subsidies. I mean, we had a national policy, basically, that we wanted to have large quantities of commodity crops, you know. So that's why we spend, you know, billions of dollars a year subsidizing, you know, corn, soybeans, rice, cotton. And any farmer will know what these crops are. And if you're like a vegetable farmer or a fruit farmer, you do not get the lion's share of these subsidies. That's part of the problem. So then we are being told, I mean, it's sort of a, you know, we have the federal government sort of schizophrenic in some ways, because we have, you know, here we have the commodity program saying grow these crops to farmers because we'll give you money to do that. And then the flip side, we have the, say, the school lunch program trying to encourage kids to eat more fruits and vegetables. But then those are more expensive. So the government itself doesn't even have a unified policy on what type of food they want to promote.
Yeah, and when it comes to what people are exposed to, not just in terms of what they can find at their supermarket, but in terms of marketing, I understand that the USDA also provides subsidized crop insurance and marketing support to a lot of these big farm businesses.
Oh, sure, yeah. You have the whole, I mean, it's basically vertical integration like you would see in any sort of corporate-controlled system where even farmers themselves are taxed. And a lot of people don't know this. Like dairy farmers, for instance, have to pay into what's called the dairy checkoff. And so they basically are – their milk check is garnished by the federal government, and that goes into the gut milk campaigns, which you see all over the place. But those are controlled by the industry. So if you're an organic milk producer, for instance, there's no gut organic milk campaigns, just gut milk campaigns. So like all the farmers are forced to pay into the system to promote these generic – crops or commodities, and then, you know, we as consumers were told to consume these things, and then, you know, to the point where, you know, it's like you're being barraged with basically consume more of this conventional junk food in a lot of cases by both, you know, corporate media and also even taxpayer subsidized propaganda.
So small local farmers are relying on farmers markets and other ways of sort of getting their message across that their food is healthier and affordable.
Right. I mean, that's what, I mean, if you're a small scale farmer, how do you let people know that you even exist? And that's been one of the challenges of the local food movement. And I want to make sure we distinguish between the local food movement and, say, the organic food movement. Because a lot of organic food, to be honest, people always ask me, well, should I buy local or buy organic? And my first response always, well, buy local. At least you know the farmer, it's from your region. You know, organic could be coming from China. We have no idea under what circumstances it was produced. Organic has nothing to say about labor rights, nothing to say about, you know, animals actually being outside, which is a whole big debate within the organic movement. So by buying local, at least you're – and part of the idea behind buying from, a say, community-supported agriculture, which is where you get a basket a week, your sort of subscription form of getting local food, or a farmer's market scenario, is you're actually putting money directly into the hands of the farmer. And that's really important because – and I try to explain this to my students at the technical college as well, that, you know, when you're paying a dollar for apples at Walmart, very, very, very little of that actually goes to the apple farmer. You know, 60% of it's all Walmart. I mean, that's the problem with the conventional food system. People complain, well, the organic food's so expensive at, you know, pick your favorite, you know, Whole Foods, Walmart, Trader Joe's, whatever. Well, part of it's because you are at the very end of this very long, expensive commodity chain. Whereas if you actually bought it directly from the farmer, it might be much less expensive. And so that's a whole challenge for consumers, is how to narrow that gap between you and the producer. If you're an eater, you know, the of course, the smallest gap would be you grow your food yourself. You know, you have your own garden or your own backyard chickens or something. But then if you can't do that, then why not go straight to the farmer? And in that situation where it's you know, it's a one-on-one relationship with you and a farmer, you actually ask the farmer questions. You have a face attached to the food. You know the farmer's saying a price that they think is fair, which is not true in the commodity conventional system at all. The farmers are forced to take prices from the buyers. They don't have much choice. Whereas at the farmer's market, the farmers can actually set their prices. And the food is three-dimensional. You can actually know all about the food. It's not just reduced to one aspect, which often their conventional food system says, well, it's just high fructose corn syrup, you know. Doesn't matter if it's GMO or not, you know, that's not, you can, in fact, you don't even have the right to know that.
So for people who are living in cities, and Madison is a city, a smaller mm-hmm. city, but a city, they perhaps don't have any land to do their own farming.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What about community gardens? What about urban gardening here in Madison?
Well, I mean, that's another one of the myths of sort of the conventional food system, is that we have just all of our food is being produced on these giant farms. And actually that's not true. I mean, around the world, 15% of the world's food is actually grown in cities now. I mean, even back, you know, during World War II, and my grandparents were involved in this, we had victory gardens. I mean, we had 20 million victory gardens all across the U.S. growing 40% of our fruits and vegetables. So people have the capacity to do this. They know how to, I mean, older people definitely know how to do this. Younger people can learn that in school or from their elders. And so even here in Madison, I mean, we have over 50 community gardens. We have almost 50,000 people growing their own gardens in their backyards. You know, and it's been estimated that this is worth almost over $9 million worth of food is grown in Madison in people's backyards. I mean, that's pretty impressive. You know, and contrast that to the fact that, you know, Wisconsin right now, we import, and a lot of people can't believe this either, but here we are in agricultural state, but you drive outside, even Dane County, you drive around, what do you see? Corn and soybeans. Corn and soybeans, some things you can't even eat half the time. So we have this disconnect between what we actually grow in the state and what we actually eat. So we import 95% of the food we eat in Wisconsin from out of state. And we are a top agricultural state. But we don't grow what we eat. So this is part of the disconnect, right? And why don't we grow what we eat? Because the federal subsidy programs encourage people to grow corn and soybeans, not fruits and vegetables.
So when it comes to local farming and CSAs, are there a lot of CSAs around Madison?
Oh, yeah. In fact, people may not – the history of CSAs originally came from Japan. It was a concept that emerged in Japan and came to the United States. And actually, we had some of the pioneers of the CSA movement in the United States here in Wisconsin. So, for instance, we had the MAX Act, Madison Area Community Support Agriculture Coalition, which has recently changed its name to something else, but that was founded here in Madison years ago, actually at Drumlin Farm, which is one of these disputed urban farms now between just the north part of Fitchburg, which we're still trying to save from development by the Novation campus. But so way back, you know, back in 1990, there were only 60 CSAs in the whole United States. And some of them were here in Wisconsin. Now we have over 13,000 across the United States. And there's over 180 in Wisconsin. So, I mean, we've seen this phenomenal growth in CSAs. It's, you know, almost 500,000 people get a CSA box every week during the summer in the United States. And that's amazing.
Do CSAs reach out to poor working class communities?
Well, they can if they're structured that way. I mean, I know here in Madison, they actually raffle off shares. You know, people put money in and you can win a share. They can also be subsidized. You know, for instance, at my house, I live in a housing co-op with 8 people. We get 2 CSA shares. Those people in my house who have health insurance, healthcare providers actually give you a rebate for CSA shares because they see fresh local food as a form of preventative medicine. So, yeah, I mean, that can be a challenge. And some CSAs have moved to a model more as a pay-as-you-go rather than you have to pay $500 at the beginning of the season. Well, instead, you can buy a box a week, you know, if that's better for your budget.
And I guess one of the things I'm alluding to are food pantries. Are CSAs right. mm-hmm. contracted at all to work and provide food to food pantries?
Well, that's a big challenge, too. I know some of the food pantries get food from after farmers markets. They can pick up extra produce that's left at the end of the day. But that's one of the big challenges with our conventional sort of hunger, anti-hunger programs. A lot of that food that's available, and I've been to food pantries, a lot of it's basically leftover junk food that taxpayers actually pay to receive. Offloaded from, you know, Kraft, I can name the big companies, but they're using it as a tax write-off, and it's also a form of marketing because then, of course, they're training people to eat, you know, mac and cheese and all this stuff through the pantries. And then how do you get more local food into, say, you know, the senior meal program, into school lunch program, another huge challenge here in Madison. There's a lot of people aren't aware that all of our food here in the Madison schools is prepared in one giant central kitchen. And so the scale is just very difficult to gain access to. I mean, the kitchens no longer, I mean, schools don't have kitchens anymore. Now they just have heating and warming unit, you know, cooling units. So, you know, when I was growing up, we had a independent, you know, consolidated school district, but we actually had a kitchen and they actually did buy local food from farmers, you know, but of course that's years ago now.
Yeah. And I do volunteer at one of the food pantries, and it's interesting because you're absolutely right. There is a preponderance of big brand names. Certainly you mentioned Kraft mac and cheese. That's a staple at all the food pantries. But there also is some locally provided fruit and vegetables that I think they collect from actually a church at the pantry mm-hmm. that I work from, a church garden.
I work with Family Farm Defenders, you know, part of the idea of food sovereignty, which is what we promote, which is very different from food security, and we could talk about the differences. But food sovereignty basically says that food is a basic human right, and having access to healthy, nutritious, culturally appropriate food, everyone has that right. So part of the problem with the local food movement is often gets derided and rightfully criticized, too. It's more of a yuppie, foodie, only wealthy, elite people should have access or can afford to buy, you know, organic, nutritious food. And that's just not, that should not be the reality, and it doesn't need to be that way. And to be honest, a lot of corporations make money off perpetuating that system.
So go ahead and let's explain the difference between food security and food sovereignty.
Well, just to make sure people know where food security came from is actually a term that was coined during the Cold War when food was being used as a weapon. And Henry Kissinger actually invoked this term at a FAO conference, I believe, in the 1970s, if I remember the history correctly. And basically the idea behind food security is that if you are our friend, we will provide you nutrition or food, if you want to call it that. But that's for our friends. So it becomes sort of a tool in the whole, you know, war at that time with Soviet Union. But then, you know, so food is reduced to basically a very, just a nutritional medium. I mean, and I've run into this problem at UW-Madison. We take food science classes there. They talk about food has 4 attributes: taste, texture, appearance, and nutrition. And that's how you market food. So is it tasty? Does it have a smooth, taste to it? Is it hydrogenated properly? Does it look nice, you know? And that's why you have the unblemished apples that have been sprayed multiple times, you know, to make sure there's not a spot on them. And then you have, you know, nutrition's always last, and that you can start working later, right? Because we can just wipe out all the nutrients in the processing, and then we'll just fortify them later. Or get people to buy vitamin supplements. So then it ends up becoming sort of the Star Trek version of food, you know, where you just sort of program it into the replicator unit and pops up whatever you want. So that's why we end up eating 70 pounds of high fructose corn syrup a year. We end up eating a lot of processed foods, which are really, you know, I mean, Michael Pollan, you know, has written a lot about this. So our food, we're eating more food and we're getting on average like only a third of the nutrition we used to get from the same amount of food, you know. So then we have to have all these supplements and so on. And so we've impoverished our food, malnutrition. And malnutrition is not just, you know, people not getting nutrients, but it's like eating the wrong things, too. So we have type 2 diabetes through the roof, which is purely caused by junk food consumption. It's not found in many places around the world, but in the U.S. is a chronic, you know, and epidemic, basically. You have childhood obesity rates through the roof. We have all sorts of allergies, you know, and so on. And a lot of it's due to just bad diet, horrible diet. And so then how do we get people back to eating wholesome, nutritious foods, you know, and people are trained to want, you know, salt and sugar and things like that.
Do you see this becoming an issue that communities will be addressing as they empower themselves? You know, we look at the Occupy movement where we're empowering ourselves against mm-hmm. the banking industry. Do you see communities empowering themselves against the food security industry and trying to maintain their own food sovereignty?
Right. Well, that's part of the, like, when the Occupy began, a lot of us in the food sovereignty movement, and this is a worldwide movement. It's not just, you know, the United States is sort of Johnny come lately to the food sovereignty struggle. But we immediately created the Occupy, the food system, sort of wing of the Occupy movement. Like, we need to reclaim, redemocratize, relocalize our food system. And that's part of what food sovereignty is all about. If you want to democratize your food system, then each community should have the right to determine, you know, what they grow, what they eat, how the food is produced, under what conditions. You know, right now we do not have that. You know, for instance, we do not have the right to know where our fruits and vegetables come from. Country of origin labeling, which we've been fighting over this in the Farm Bill for multiple years now, only applies now to meat and, you know, some seafood. You know, but it's like not, they're refusing, they don't, to be honest, the food industry does not want you to know where their food comes from. Because if you knew it came from China, you might be worried about it, and you should be worried about it. And same thing goes with genetic engineering. Like, you go to anywhere in Europe, and on all the packaging, it will tell you, genetically modified soy lecithin, genetically modified if it's in there, and you can avoid it. Here, we're not allowed to do that. In fact, if you try to do that, Monsanto might sue you. Which has happened to many independent, you know, food processors who try to be, you know, have truth in labeling for consumers. And consumers want to know this information, and then they're denied the right to know it. So, you know, or whether it's irradiated, or whether it's, you know, comes from cloned animals, or whether it, you know, it's been, you know, carbon monoxide's been pumped into the package to keep the meat looking red. Whether it's pink slime, the latest, you know, thing on the menu. I mean, the list of things in our food system they don't want you to know about is just amazing. And then at the same time, people know everything about the apps on their phone. They know everything about, you know, some sort of esoteric, you know, electronic item. But then, like, the contrived ignorance of our food system is incredibly profitable.
If anyone listening wants to find out more about the work that you do, how can they find out?
Well, we do have a website. It's familyfarmdefenders.org. So you can always go there. We usually have a booth at the Eastside Farmers Market, which will be starting up soon, Tuesdays from 4 to 7 at the Wilmar Community Center. Yeah, we just encourage people. I mean, you know, this is food, you know, local food is a really important part of the food sovereignty movement, and we encourage people, and now's the time to think about gardening. Get your seeds in the ground.
John Peck, thanks for being our guest this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Speaking of food sovereignty, health writer Gary Karch reports on a community garden being started at Union Corners.
I'm standing here at the corner of East Washington and Milwaukee Street on land that's called Union Corners. Union Corners used to have industry and retail on it, and it has since been demolished. It's been empty for many years. There's been talk about transitional use, meaning using the land before it gets developed. And I am here today on a beautiful Earth Day. Well, so tell me your name and what you're doing here.
I'm Julie Fitzpatrick, and I'm a first grade teacher at Elvium Elementary. And I'm here representing Transition Madison. And we're a group that recognizes that there are big changes coming to our society and that we need to do whatever we can to ease the transition. So we look for projects that are going on that seem to build community resilience, and then we pitch in and lend a hand to those projects.
Uh-huh. And describe how this project here will help that community resilience.
Well, Union Corners is an area that stood vacant for quite a while now, and Joe Mingle got a lease from the city, permission to do something. So a bunch of community groups have gotten together to take the area and put in some food beds. And the food that's raised in these garden beds will go to support various food pantries in the city. Mm-hmm. So CAC is involved, Community Action Coalition, and East Side, let's see, it's the East Side Pantry is involved.
East Side Pantry Brigade, that's
Brigade,
what I read.
That's right.
Yes.
And then the Transition Madison, Permaculture Guild, there's quite a few. A couple of student organizations from East, and it builds resiliency by introducing different parts of the community to each other so that we all learn to work together.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Happy Earth Day.
You too.
And standing with me is Joe Mingle, an organizer with Community Garden Project. Joe, hello.
Hi, my name is Joe Mingle, and I'm an urban farmer and community activist. I'm a member of the Dane County Food Council and the East Isthmus Neighborhoods Planning Council. I'm one of the organizers of the event today at Union Corners. We're building, the city of Madison has given us a permit to build 10 raised beds at Union Corners to grow food for the Fritz Food Pantry at the Goodman Center. So we have a bunch of volunteers out here today from a variety of organizations, ranging from the Planning Council to Transition Madison, the Permaculture Guild, Mentoring Positives, and a variety of other community partners who are helping build beds, plant them, and get everything ready.
And how did you end up getting involved in this?
I'm an urban farmer, like I said, and I have a network of food pantry gardens on the east side that I grow food for different food pantries. I'm also have been involved for several years in an effort to restart a community effort to develop Union Corners. And since I was looking for some additional land to grow food, and this was sitting here empty, it seemed like a great opportunity to get something going at Union Corners and also grow some more food for needy families.
Mm-hmm. And who is going to be able to get this food? Where is this food going to be distributed to?
This food is all going to go right over to the Goodman Center, to the Fritz Food Pantry there. There are a variety of other food pantry gardens that I'm involved with. Some of it goes to the Salvation Army on Darbo Drive, the community center food pantry there. Some of the food that's grown by the Pantry Brigade on the east side goes to the homeless shelter, the Salvation Army Homeless Shelter Kitchen, which is down on East Wash. There's a lot of produce that's generated from donations at the farmers market and other farmers that we're going to be distributing. Holy Cross Lutheran Church right behind us here has given Mentoring Positives an acre of land to grow food this year, and we'll be using that for the Off the Block Salsa Project, but we'll also be distributing some of that food just to families in the neighborhood.
Now, Joe, I hear that there is a youth group involved with this, with the Goodman Center. How?
Well, the Goodman Center has a really excellent youth group called Teenworks, which helps run the cafe. And some of their members will be helping out with managing the gardens this summer. I don't think any of them are here right now. There is also a crew of youth associated with Operation Fresh Start, who are interested in starting to get involved in some urban agriculture. And then I work with a group called Mentoring Positives, which is based in the Worthington Park neighborhood. It's headed by Will Green. He'll be speaking at the dedication ceremony later today. And Mentoring Positives works with at-risk teens, and one of the projects I work with them on is Off the Block Salsa, where at-risk teens grow local produce and make it into salsa that they sell as a fundraiser.
Great.
There's a lot of teens involved. There's actually some students from East High here working, and, you know, hopefully many of the youth and people coming up will be involved in urban agriculture, become farmers, and be part of rebuilding a relocalized and more resilient local food system.
That's great. Say, what kind of food is going to be grown here?
We'll be just growing a lot of vegetables on these beds. Okra, mustard greens, collard greens, hot peppers. We'll also be doing stuff like radishes, carrots, lettuce, cilantro, stuff like that. It's not a huge amount of space. We only have 10 4x6 beds, but we'll be able to produce a fair amount of food here for the pantry. So.
And I see that you are not building wooden sides on these beds.
Just building beds right on the surface. There's a foot or so of wood chips underneath a couple feet of soil, and we're not putting them in enclosures. It's all temporary. Mm-hmm. This is city-owned land. I got permission from the city to use it just for the growing season, and I told them that we would return it to its original state when the season was over. So we're not building permanent enclosures. We're just building temporary beds on the soil.
Well, best of luck to you. I think it's a fantastic idea.
Well, and I want to thank all your listeners out there for many people in this community have contributed to creating the infrastructure of local food, like the farmers market, the co-ops, the CFSAs, and other parts of our community. And it's really provided the basis for the work that I am building on now, right? It's other people in the community who have done years of service building up the local food movement who have created the conditions that allow projects like this to happen. And so, you know, the interest and support for this kind of work exists at the county level with the Food Council and Dane County Executive Joe Parisi. The mayor is very interested in this sort of stuff. And obviously the Neighborhood Association, the Planning Council, and people at the grassroots. And for those of you who have built the local food movement over the years, I want to thank you for all your work, because it's your work that has created the conditions that allow us to do these projects now. So,
thank you so much,
Excellent.
Joe.
Thank you very much. Happy Earth Day, everybody.
You bet.
Right on.
Well, thanks for that report from Union Corners, Gary. That just about wraps up our program on food sovereignty. I know you have a follow-up to the KIPP story that you did on our April 12th program.
Late last week, it was announced that a lawsuit against the Madison KIPP Corporation over contamination of residential properties by an industrial solvent had been granted class action status and expanded from 7 to 34 homes. The 7 homes are clustered in the location originally discovered to have been contaminated with perchloroethylene, or PCE. The additional homes were added after PCE contamination was found to have spread to their properties as well. And if that weren't enough, a completely different contaminant, PCB, or polychlorinated biphenyl, had been discovered on the KIPP property. The Department of Justice contacted Madison KIPP outlining minimum sampling requirements on the newly found pollution and specified a May 1st deadline for them to outline their plan to sample the surrounding area to determine the contamination's spread. Additionally, the Wisconsin DNR issued a responsible party letter to Madison KIPP Corporation informing them of their legal responsibilities for cleanup. This letter gives the company 90 days to address specific concerns. In a neighborhood update of April 19th, the DNR stated that KIPP's failure to address issues in the responsible party letter may result in further state and possibly federal enforcement action, in addition to the current DNR referral of KIPP to the Department of Justice. Obviously, this is only a brief summary. For a more complete explanation of these recent developments and background information on the KIPP pollution, listeners may go to the Wisconsin DNR website at dnr.wi.gov and search for KIPP.
Well, thanks for that report, Gary. And if you want to hear Gary's report from 2 weeks ago and his interview with Lance Green on the KIPP situation, you can go to the Health Writers website at healthwriters.wordpress.com.